Good morning and welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, Friday, April 29th. And apologize for the late start. We were scheduled to start at 9 o'clock. We're a little bit late. And part of it is we had some technical difficulties with PowerPoint, I understand. And but I appreciate members being here this morning early. We do have a long agenda today. I hope it's not too long. We've got a number of bills. We're going to try to complete our policy bill today. But before we did that, I did want to take advantage of an opportunity that we have to hear from Dr. Earl Grinnells. And he is in town. He was in town yesterday evening for a presentation. And given the, I think, the timeliness, we have in this legislature some bills dealing with casino gaming. We seem to have those issues perennially before us. And I thought it would be helpful for the members of the legislature and others to have an opportunity to hear some of the what I would think of as the other side of the story. Typically, when we talk about gambling as a possible alternative to some of the things we're looking at in our, as we face our budgetary issues, typically it's talked about in terms of the additional revenue that would accrue to the state to do these things. And we have not, at least in my experience in the legislature, talked very much about whether or not there are costs or things that might weigh against those revenues. And Dr. Grinnells is someone that I heard speak a few years ago. He has done research and is considered a leader in this field. I thought it would be helpful to have a presentation about what we're calling the social costs of casino gaming. And so I would appreciate your indulgence here as we have a brief presentation and some discussion. And I think there'll be an opportunity for members of the committee to ask questions. But I think that you'll find this of interest, and I hope it is helpful as we think about these issues going forward. So I'd like to invite Annette Meeks to come forward and introduce our guest. She was responsible for the event that he appeared at last night, and I thought that she might be well-suited to introduce our presenter, Ms. Meeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Annette Meeks, and I'm CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota, a nonprofit educational organization that focuses on some of the toughest issues facing the state. And as such, and certainly by the crowd this morning, I think gambling might be one of those issues. We are here this morning to learn from one of the America's foremost economists on the social and economic costs of gambling in America. As all of you know, it's no mystery to you. We've been wrestling with this issue for many years now, and it's a difficult debate on how and when and if we even should expand gambling in the state of Minnesota. Supporters of gambling, many believe that the cost to society are low and the potential benefits to the state are high enough to justify the social ills that occur when casinos spring up in neighborhoods. Dr. Grinnells is here today to talk to you about those issues and to shed some light on the research that he's done for nearly a decade on this, on this important issue. Dr. Grinnells is a distinguished professor of economics at Baylor University. After undergraduate work at the University of Michigan and the University of Minnesota, where he received two summa cum laude degrees in mathematics and economics, Professor Grinnells earned his Ph.D. at MIT in 1977. Dr. Grinnells has held positions in government and academia, including Cornell University, the University of Chicago, the University of Washington, the University of Illinois, the Department of the Treasury, and a senior economist for the Council of Economic Advisors. Dr. Grinnells' work has resulted in many articles and books in the fields of international economics, public finance, and macroeconomics. He's testified before Congress and numerous state capitals in the economics of gambling and currently works on the economics of national health care, another issue of interest to this committee. Professor Grinnells is one of the first academians to recommend to Congress in 1994 that it should establish a national commission to study the impact of casino gambling. The National Gambling Impact Study Commission was formed in 1996, and that's also when I first heard of Dr. Grinnells' work, and produced its final report in 1999 recommending a moratorium on casino gambling. Dr. Grinnells' gambling research is presented in a book, Gambling in America, which I highly recommend, The Costs and Benefits. Dr. Grinnell's current research focuses on access, personal, portable, and permanent insurance coverage, respect for incentives for high-quality care, cost containment, and sustainability through health insurance reform and health care reform. His 2009 book, Health Care for Us All, Getting More for Our Investment, was recently published, and after I talked to him about that, it appears I might have to be bringing him back before this committee sometime soon to talk about that issue as well. With that, I hope you'll join me in welcoming Professor Earl Grinnell.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
And Dr. Grinnell, can I interrupt you for 1 second and just ask you if you would, could you sit at the table? We need to catch your remarks on tape, but we are recording this, and there's a microphone there. Please help us out. Sometimes the room gets a little noisy, but... And first, I want to thank you for taking the time to come and present to our committee.
So if I sit here, I'm going to have somebody forward the slides over there.
All right. Very good.
I want to begin just by pointing out that my research began in the early 1990s and has continued on and off since then. My main research, as already pointed out, has to do with the economics of healthcare, and that's my current focus. The research that I've done on gambling has not been sponsored by pro-gambling or anti-gambling groups. It has been independent research, and I here more or less as a public service. So that's how I view myself. Back.
And Dr. Grinnell's.
That's the correct one.
Can I ask you to bring the microphone close so that we can be sure to hear your comments? Thank you.
This arrangement actually is better than most state capitals with respect to testifying. The fact that you've got a PowerPoint capability at all is remarkable. Okay. This first slide gives you some numbers, and this is I'm trying to give you the bottom line at the beginning just to get the orders of magnitude here. There are two bars shown. The one on the right is a measure of the social benefits of gambling. That is the value that having an additional form of recreation available is to the population. So if you imagine a society with no gambling present at all, and then the alternative where you introduce the gambling opportunity, and you were to ask every individual in the society, how much is it worth to you to pay in order to have this opportunity available, it is possible to infer that number from information on how much people gamble when they're different distances away from casino locations. And the number shown here is updated. The handouts that you have updated everything into 2010 dollars. So the numbers that you have on the sheet that was handed out are a little bit more current in 2010 dollars. But the main thing here is that this number is an upper bound on the value of gambling. It is the social value and benefit in totality to all of society of having this additional form of recreation. The issue of where those benefits end up when the gambling opportunity is introduced has to do with how it is offered. Now, in the state of Minnesota, you have regional monopolies, or they're essentially Elizabethan-style crown monopolies, where you have granted casino rights to a special group. No one can compete with them, and so much of the gains that are being shown here end up in the hands of the monopoly owners, which would be different if this were offered in the form of the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, where any entrant who wanted to have a casino could enter and compete. The same thing would be true in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So depending on how the gambling is introduced into your economy, the gains accrue to different people. Those people who enjoy gambling do get some benefits because they didn't have the opportunity before. They enjoy it. It's unharmful to them, and they get the chance to gamble. So some of the benefits accrue to the gamblers themselves. Now, on the left is the bar, which is roughly three times higher, And that shows the social costs that gambling spins off. If gambling had no social costs, primarily operating through the presence of problem and pathological gamblers and the creation of new pathological gamblers, we wouldn't be meeting to discuss the issue, because in the absence of social costs, you've added a benefit without any counterbalancing costs. The red bar, the red portion of the bar, is crime-related costs. Social service costs are the white portion of the bar, and the other costs I've just grouped together in yellow. But the main number, which I've summarized in your sheet, is that the social costs taken in taken together and added across all bearers of those costs, combined and compared to the benefits, outweigh the benefits by a factor of roughly 3 to 1. So even as research allows us to refine these numbers, and I am engaged in research that is currently being conducted in Canada, where we should be able to refine some of these numbers, I don't think that we're going to find that gambling will suddenly reverse and pass a cost-benefit test. At the moment, society as a whole is better off without gambling present at all, and that is, in fact, the state that the nation adopted and was in roughly through most of the 20th century. It was the last quarter of the 20th century that the expansion, the modern wave of gambling expansion occurred. Okay, next slide. This table is produced from a New Hampshire Policy Research Institute study that came out just last year, but it adopts more or less the same taxonomy of social costs that I have used. And the main item on this table, which I think is important, is that they have included the type of cost, and in the next column, the bearer of the costs, because many social costs of gambling are paid by family members, close relatives of the gambler himself, but many of them are publicly borne costs, and about 40% of the costs are tax-related publicly borne costs. And that is what makes gambling a public policy issue. Personally, I tend more toward a libertarian approach. If you want to do technical rock climbing or hang gliding, and that's going to be dangerous or harmful to yourself, I'm inclined to let you go ahead. But if your decision to gamble is going to cost me money and I have to pay taxes to clean up messes that your choice creates, then I think I have a say about it. And that's why it's a public policy issue, not just a personal matter of if you want to gamble, you should be able to do what you want. I'll just go down the list of these social costs, but they are crime, business and employment costs. If your firm has 100 employees and just one of them becomes a pathological gambler, which is approximately the number that we would select, and you have to fire that individual, you have to hire a new individual, retrain the new individual, these are costs which wouldn't be present in the absence of that situation. Bankruptcy, mental illness, suicide. We have no numbers on suicide, but that is a main, a well-known social consequence of gambling. Social service costs, direct regulatory costs of government, unlike, I don't know, ice cream stands maybe, gambling requires more direct oversight than does conventional business. Family costs, abused dollars, and they even have listed on their table political costs. I'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. Okay, next slide. Now, I have given you numbers, and early on, I would have been happy to spend all the time talking about numbers, but what I discovered is that people don't really connect with the numbers unless they understand what the numbers mean. The costs that we're talking about are very real, and so I'd like to present just a few newspaper clippings that show the kind of social costs that we're talking about. This first item happens to be from Mississippi. The title here reads, In Gulf Casino's Wake, a Pawn Shop Boom. Question, next slide. This is a similar story from Iowa, but you might ask how many of you pawn your personal and family possessions for recreation purposes. If you're pawning objects to gamble, there's something else going on. This is not simply recreation for the people that are gambling. A quick little story that I told last night. In Branson, Missouri, one of the entertainers who came to speak on a conference dealing with the issue of should gambling move into Branson, Missouri, and Branson at the time did reject that offer. The entertainer said, "I entertain both in Las Vegas and in Branson. I know what gambling is, and I don't think Branson should introduce it, and so on. I can't speak directly against it because I'm making my living off of Las Vegas entertaining." But he said this. He went to a pawn shop in Las Vegas and asked the owner at the counter, "So what's the most interesting thing that you've ever had pawned?" And the owner pulled out a mason jar, kind of a large pickle jar, kind of a large jar, that was two-thirds filled with gold fillings. And the pawn shop owner said that the people were pawning their gold fillings at his pawn shop. And at this point, the entertainer became emotional. He had a hard time finishing his story. But he said, "And then he told me that a third of the people who came in to pawn their fillings pulled the fillings out of their teeth right there at the counter. You know, they asked for a pair of pliers and just said, 'Here, take this gold and give me some money.'" So there's some additional stuff going on here that we have to be aware of. Next slide. Okay, this is a Colorado Gazette Telegraph headline. Says, "Hike in crime follows gambling." I'm going to give you some information about that. We know crime is caused by many, many things. Gambling is just one of many causes of crime, but we can statistically identify and ferret out how much of the crime is due to the introduction of gambling, and I'll give you some of those numbers in just a moment. This is the title page to an article that appeared just a few months ago. I think it was October or November of last year in the Journal of Quantitative Criminology, and I have selected one of their summary items on the right. They found in investigating slot machines in Victoria, Australia, that about 10% of the income-generating crimes in that area were due to the presence of the slot machines. In other words, if they took their statistical estimates, set the numbers of gambling to zero, there would be 10% less crime. Okay, and I'm just going to give you a few other examples. This is an accountant. It says, "Accountant dies before repaying stolen funds, $4 million. This happens to be Iowa. Another one, this is Wisconsin, also close to home. Young man who took out a number of credit cards illegally, I guess, in his father's name and ran up balances on all of them and ended up with $170,000 in debt before he was finally stopped. Okay, next slide. These are two clippings. One of these is Illinois on the left. This was a woman who had no known problems, no psychological issues. She began to gamble, eventually started using their house mortgage payments and also used college savings that they had for their children. Her husband was called home by the sheriff because the sheriff was heading to the house to foreclose on the mortgage. Arriving at the house, the sheriff discovered a suicide note. The husband and the sheriff then together went to a local parking lot not too far away where they found the woman's body. And this was the very first notion that this man had that there was any problem. He went from knowing nothing of any problems in his family to a dead wife and foreclosed home. Another one on the right, gambled to death. Suicides, individuals leaving the casinos in Connecticut, hanging themselves by their own belts on trees on the way home. I can produce many, many, many stories like this. I'm not claiming that they're prevalent. If you take 100 people, you're not going to have a lot of these stories, but I will give you the orders of magnitude and how it leads to the social costs that I'm talking about. This one is to make another point. This is South Dakota, and the picture here shows a young girl. She's holding her mother's picture. This girl was graduating from high school. On her graduation day, the article explained she came home and was very worried about opening her mother's door for fear of what she would find and so on and so forth. At any rate, the mother had gotten into slot machine gambling in the South Dakota casinos, had overextended herself, I guess, committed suicide, and her body was in her bedroom. And this poor girl who had no... These are the innocent lives that are affected, and so gambling affects more than just the people who are doing the gambling. Okay, what about the economics of gambling? This data happens to be from Illinois, but it is confirmed pretty much around the country, and it is the following. If you see these bars, what these are is the percentage of the revenue dollars collected by distance from the casino. These numbers have been tabulated for Atlantic City. In fact, there's even a regularity. It's not quite an exponential decline as you go further distances from the casino, but there are norms that people can use to estimate. In fact, the casino industry uses these norms to estimate their revenues, how many people live at what distance away. The largest bar are people who live less than 35 miles away. So most of the money that a convenience casino of the type that we're talking about here are coming from nearby residents. And it drops off fairly quickly to very little when you get out 50 miles, 75 miles. So most of the money is coming from nearby residents. And in addition, we know that people do not tend to travel past a casino in order to gamble at another one of a comparable style. They simply don't do that. That means that in the case of Minnesota, since you're surrounded by gambling states, Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, I'm not sure what the case is in North Dakota, you're not likely to be attracting people who will be traveling across the state line past their own casinos in order to come here. In other words, the revenues being collected in Minnesota are almost surely coming predominantly from Minnesotans. Now, there may be a little bit of tourist money going into the casinos, but you have to consider that as local money already. I was in Hawaii a couple of months ago. They had 19 bills introduced this session for one form or another of gambling, and the state again rejected them. Hawaii has figured out that the money that would be coming from their casino, should they introduce them, would be coming from tourists. But these are already part of the tourist base of Hawaii. Therefore, they should be considered local demand already. And that's the case for many of the people who come to Minnesota for recreation. Okay, this particular slide is to make a point. Yes.
Mr. Grinnell, I want to interrupt for a moment. We do have a question, and I think it might be appropriate to take questions as they come up. So, Senator Berglund, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted the doctor to explain what these different colored bars stand for on this chart.
Okay, and Dr. Grinnell, if you...
Okay, yeah, he forwarded one slide ahead of where I was, but that's fine. Yes, these bars... make a particular point. On the far left is the only... There was one national commission formed in the early 1970s that produced a report in 1975. We did not have the South Oaks gambling screen at that time, and so the evidence, as best it was known, about the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling is shown on the bars on the left. The red is the proportion of the population in 1975 that they found or deemed to be pathological gamblers. The green bar is problem gamblers. These are people who answer questions on a screen in the wrong way. In other words, I stole money to feed my gambling habit, or I have lost a significant personal relationship over my gambling, questions of that type. And if you answer a certain number wrong, they say, okay, that's indication you're a pathological gambler. If you answer many of them wrong but not at the same degree, then you would be deemed a problem gambler. The technical term is pathological gambler. On the far right, I'll just go to that, is Las Vegas. This is the only study that's ever been done of the prevalence in Las Vegas, of which I'm aware, and Las Vegas for years and years resisted ever taking doing any studies of this sort. But you can see that the higher degree of pathological gambling in the red bar on the far right, and the yellow bars sum the problem and pathological rates in one number. So what you can glean from this is, if you take the country a little bit to the left of the left bars, because after all, in 1975 we did have gambling casino-level gambling in the country. And you so reduce those bars a little bit and then go to Las Vegas. I think Las Vegas is probably a good indication of how far the increase in problem and pathological gambling would be taken if you had enough gambling in your economy. And so that just gives you some notion of the relative orders of magnitude here. Okay, next slide. Revenues that gambling takes in have been, as I've said, have been figured to come primarily from nearby residents and from locals. This particular graph is from a study done by the New Mexico Taxation and Revenue Department in 1996. No, I guess it was a little later, about 98. Anyway, the late 90s. And their story is the following. New Mexico has American Indian tribes. They had bingo-level games on their reservations and illegally expanded those to casino gambling. The state retroactively legalized that, but at the time of legalization, when some more casinos entered and so on, the state revenue department did this study. What this chart is showing is their revenues, tax revenues, relative to trend line. So the trend line is the horizontal line up on the left-hand portion of the graph. This is data running from January 84 through around 96 or 97. And for 10 years, you see that the revenue in the state of New Mexico followed essentially the trend line. It's bouncing around the trend line. Now, there's an obvious break in the following of the trend line in 1994 and thereafter. They deem that was due to the introduction of the Indian casinos. And I'll give you just one other. They had more graphs and so on. This is just one. This is their figure six. This is total retail taxes collected, and it also shows a break from trend line in 1994. Okay, go to the next slide. In the study, they analyze this in various ways, but the conclusion that they ultimately reach is that they had $45 million in unrealized tax collections in return for $38 million that the casinos in their compacts were providing the state. So what they were essentially saying was, we made a bad deal here. We're losing more money in these other ways than we're gaining from the taxes that we are getting from the casinos. And that should not be surprising. Money doesn't grow on trees, and it doesn't come from nothing. Any money that you're getting, and I don't know the details of Minnesota's arrangement with your casinos here, but you have to consider that you are losing tax revenue in some way because of their presence in the state. And if you're not collecting enough revenues directly from the casinos, then the net effect is a negative. Okay, next slide. What I'm doing is going through the economic arguments very briefly here. But another argument that is made is that casinos are a way to economically develop a region. I know that there are issues with respect to sports stadiums in Minnesota, and there's a close analogy. Here is the analogy and the deal that is being offered. If you will allow us to introduce casinos, we will economically develop your community. In return, you're going to have to pay social costs that go with the casino, but you'll get the economic development. That is the deal, essentially, that Las Vegas has made. They have very high social costs, but in their case, they're doing better because of the gambling. In the case of a sports stadium, the deal is, if you'll allow taxpayers to pay the cost of the stadium, then the stadium will help economically develop your region. Both promises are viewed by economists almost universally as bogus promises for the following reason. If you go to the books that have been written on the sports stadium literature, which is identical to the analysis you do for casinos, they have titles like Major League Losers. That's the title of one book by economists examining the issue. Field of Schemes is another title of another book. It's unusual to have such agreement on an issue, but there is agreement when it comes to the stadium literature, and it, as I said, economically it's logically identical to the casino issue. So let me just quickly do this. Imagine three alternative ways that economic activity can take place. One would be what I call the factory. You introduce a factory into an area. It produces a product that it sells to people outside the geographic area of interest. That brings in new money. That expands your economy both by adding jobs and by increasing the well-being of your existing residents. Now, in this graph, think of the original box as the size of your economy. The height is the well-being. The horizontal dimension is number of jobs. So in this case, a factory both increases well-being and expands jobs. Okay, next. But you can also have what I call the toll house model or situation. And that's where you have an economy, let's say it's 100, a certain number of jobs, certain level of well-being of existing residents. In this case, you introduce a casino. It brings in money from the outside, but it might be owned by outside owners or people who are not part of the local community. So they bring in money, they take it away. There's no net impact on the local community. Okay, next. And this third one is what I call the restaurant. If you were to imagine introducing another restaurant into St. Paul or another restaurant into Minneapolis, you would figure that the restaurant could do quite well. It could hire people. It could sell meals. But it would probably be taking demand away from and diverting it from other restaurants in the community. Nobody would believe that by introducing a restaurant into St. Paul or into Minneapolis that you're going to economically expand the economic base of either city. You're going to divert money that would have been used some other place. Restaurants somewhere else will lose a little bit of their demand, and the restaurant that you're looking at will gain demand at their expense. Now, in this particular case, the original box in dark green is the original economy. You've introduced a gambling sector, so you're going to expand the gambling sector by shrinking something else in the economy. And in the case of gambling, you're introducing social costs. That's the rectangle up at the top. Now, if you just take a look at the remaining dark green, you see that this has been a loss to the local economy. In the back of my book, I give a well-worked-out example showing a situation like this one where all the numbers look good. The casino is paying taxes. It's hiring people. It's doing quite well. And yet the net impact on the local economy has been negative, and you've actually harmed your existing residents. Okay. How am I doing time-wise? I want to make sure I'm not...
You're doing fine. Thank you.
All right, let me just move on and put this slide up. This is Nevada in recent years. And the reason I put together this particular slide is at one of these types of hearings, I had a question, and the individual spoke this way. He said, you claim that gambling has all these social costs and it's a real problem, but, you know, I've been to Las Vegas. It looked fine to me. Everything looked great. And I just don't buy it. It was essentially what he was saying. And I thought, you know, he's actually right. If there is any impact that should be visible, we should be able to find it in Nevada. 60% of the economy there is due to casinos or the gambling industry. And so I began to collect social statistics. Now, what I want to tell you is these social statistics do not put Nevada or Las Vegas at the top of the list of the worst locations each and every year, but many years they are near the top of the list or at the top of the list. And so Nevada is first in suicide, which is about double the national average. They're first in divorce, first in women killed by men, first in gambling addictions. You've seen that already. They're first in child death by abuse in this number of years, first in deaths per vehicle miles driven, first in per capita bankruptcy rate, most dangerous place to live, most bankruptcies per capita, highest dropout rate for public high schools, lowest percentage of graduates who go on to college, second for worst credit scores, third for children abused or neglected, third in abortions, fourth in rape, fourth in out-of-wedlock births, fourth in alcohol-related deaths, fifth for lawsuits. I have not updated this list, but if I were to go to the statistical abstract of the U.S., you could produce more items for this list. Yes.
Dr. Grills, let me interrupt you for 1 second. Senator Marty has a question.
Mr. Chairman, could we get a copy of that slide?
Sure.
Yeah. And Mr. Grinnell's, or Dr. Grinnell's, perhaps we could get a copy of your entire presentation that we could make for interested members.
I'll provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
So again, I am not claiming that Nevada each and every year has these statistics, but they are frequently and prominently on these lists regularly, and you can find a comparable list quite easily. This next slide is a statement from Representative John Bradley. He did invite me down to speak to the Illinois legislature, and I was quite surprised. Mostly these are quixotic events, because gambling is a one-way ticket. Once you've got it, no example that I'm aware of in modern history has ever reversed or diminished gambling once it's entered a state. The direction is always and everywhere for expansion. And that comes from pressure by the industry because, as you'd expect, they're making a lot of money this way. And it's not, if the industry had a way to eliminate the social costs and the spin-off of damage, I think the industry seriously and honestly would do that. It's just not possible. And so they are saddled with an unfortunate circumstance, which is that their product creates problems, and they can't get away from that. But we can talk about the industry again. At any rate, Bradley was successful. He got the Illinois House of Representatives to pass a bill to eliminate all gambling in the state of Illinois. He just couldn't get it through the Senate. And so it's just difficult. But here's what he said. Our state's become reliant on an industry that, rather than a boon, has actually been a drain on our resources. It's time that we have the courage to recognize that gambling is a failure and that we must end this 15-year social experiment that's done far more harm than good. The people of this state were sold a bill of goods when the legislature approved casinos, and it's time we cut our losses and cash out. In the case of Illinois, the reason for introducing casinos was to redevelop certain depressed riverboat area towns and certain regions of the state that they thought needed economic development. In fact, you can show that the development didn't occur in most of those locations. In some, there was a benefit. In most, there was not. Okay, next slide. And I'm going to end with just a little bit on crime, which is one of the social costs. And I did a study with a co-author that was published in a very well-respected economics journal in 2006. We had 20 years of data, and every county in the United States as part of our sample. And what we wanted to find out was what consequence was there for crime in counties that introduced casino-level, Class 3-level gambling to those locations. Now, interestingly, what we found is that other studies that had come prior to us, first of all, didn't have as much data as we had, and they hadn't been as thorough. But by averaging all the before and after numbers, what they were doing was inappropriately averaging 3 or 4 years subsequent to introduction that we found it took 4 or 5 years for the impacts to build and to show. And so by averaging, they were averaging no impacts with some impacts and thus statistically unable to distinguish anything. Well, we were able to get the numbers out. Okay, what you're looking at is 7 FBI index crime rates are, yes, and they are normed at 100. The baseline at the far left is normed at 100, so that's the standard level of these crimes, just to set everything to a common baseline. And what you see is that for the first 4 years shown, you're going across in years here from time of opening. This is 4 years before opening the casino to 7 years after opening the casino. There's a little drop in the middle. That is the year of opening of the casino. So we took all of our data, set it to baseline on year of opening, 4 years before to 7 years after, set the crime rates so that their levels were set to 100. So this is just so you can see the orders of magnitude. And notice, for the 4 years before casino opening in the counties of the United States, there's not a lot going on in terms of crime. They were all pretty much, crime bounces up and down, but it was pretty flat. The year of opening, there's a little bit of a dip in crime. So it actually looks like, it improved things. Now, you go about 3 years out, and you don't notice a whole lot of effects, but about 4, 5, and 6 years, you start to notice significant impacts. Okay, next slide. Now, this is raw data. We haven't done anything to the data yet. This is interesting because we also took all Indian compact counties in the United States. And we plot across the bottom of this screen all the FBI Index 1 crimes. Now, what you're looking at is a frontier. Take just the black line. It shows for each crime the degree to which the crime rate in those areas was above the national average. So if I can, this is zero, but this is the national average. So what this is showing you is that in robbery, counties that at some point got an Indian compact casino had robbery rates that were exactly on the national average.
Okay. I'm sorry, Dr. Grinnells, I'm going to have to ask you to stay close to the microphone because we can't pick up your comments. So I'm sorry.
All right. At any rate, so I just want to make sure people are following what the graph is showing.
I understand.
So if you look at some of the other crimes, you'll see that these compact counties had elevated crime rates already relative to the rest of the country's average. But the important point about this is in 1987, the frontier was the black line. In 1992, 5 years later, the frontier was the green line. It had altered a little bit, but not a lot. The red line is the 1996 frontier, and it has risen for each and every single one of those crimes. And what happened between 92 and 96 is the introduction of the casinos. That is the period of time in which those Indian compacts began operation. So it's an indication that there is an impact, and I can show you some more numbers. Okay, next slide. These are post-regression numbers. Let me just focus on the one on the left, which is aggravated assault. Again, these are leads and lags centered on year of casino opening. And you'll see in the graph there are vertical bars with a center line. The center line is the regression estimate of that crime. And the vertical bars that you see on those indicate the 95% confidence interval. So we're not ever sure what the true number is. We do the best the estimate can give us. But we believe with 95% probability the true number is within that vertical bar. And you'll notice that the vertical bar for the first 4 or 5 moving from the left contains the zero line. That means that we cannot statistically distinguish anything different between casino counties and non-casino counties in these crime rates prior to opening of the casino. That's the fact that those bars encompass the zero line means grab all the casino counties in the country, any county that would get a casino, grab all the non-casino counties, look at their crime rates. You can't distinguish them. They look the same. The models predict similar kinds of things. Okay, then there's the year of opening. You go another 2 or 3 years, and then you start to see a rise in the crime rates. And that is what we found for most of the crimes. Now, for murder, we were not able to find a connection. It didn't show up in the data. Murder is generally caused for a lot of things unrelated to something like gambling, although murders have been committed because of gambling. That is a fact. But if you look at, what do I have here, rape, aggravated assault, larceny, burglary, there is an elevation of the crime rate 3 or 4 years after introduction. It does take a while for these problems to fully materialize. Okay, I could go on very long, but it will stop here because I think we probably at this point could get better information transmitted through answering questions.
And Dr. Grinnells, I appreciate your presentation, and we would appreciate having a copy of it. I did want to ask you a little bit about, and I know you've made comments in the past, and I've read some of your material, but to distinguish the different kinds of gambling. We have many forms of gambling in the society. Certainly in Minnesota, we have lottery. We have charitable gambling of various kinds. We have racetracks. But I think you have tried to distinguish that some forms of gambling are more benign or less harmful than others. And could you comment a little bit on that?
Yes. The Crack cocaine, as it's called, of gambling is the slot machine, the electronic gambling machine, the video lottery terminal that goes by different names. And the evidence is that the time to pathology, the time to creation of a pathological gambler, is shortened from about 3 or 3.5 years down to closer to 1 year if the form of gambling is the slot machine. Slot machines also tend to gather more of their revenues from problem and pathological gamblers. The best study of which I'm aware was done in Canada. They were, I know the investigator, they were extremely careful. They used gambling diaries, and there's a very, if the committee wants, it can get a copy of their research paper where they describe what they did. But I trust their numbers. They found that slot machines gather about 60%, actually their number was 58%, but roughly 60% of the revenues of slot machines come from problem and pathological gamblers. These are the people who are at the machines at all hours of the day or night. These are the people that lose significant social, economic relationships because of their gambling and so on. And I will make a comment. It's a norm in the industry that casinos take in roughly 80% of their revenues from slot machines. So if you, and I know that Minnesota, as many states do, has had proposals to put slot machines in other locations like racetracks and so on. The racetrack industry tends not to do well when other forms of gambling are around. And so they, of course, not unexpectedly would like to protect themselves, so they want slot machines. The argument is made that we already have a footprint in racing here, and so putting slot machines in here won't change that footprint. But that's absolutely untrue. There's a very big difference between putting in slot machines, which can be operating 24/7, and races, which have to be held at certain times of the year and certain specific times. At any rate, so putting in slot machines is essentially creating a casino wherever you put them in. And if you do the math, if as a norm about 80%, and sometimes it's higher, can be 90%, but if you have 80% of your revenues coming from slot machines and 60% of those revenues are coming from problem and pathological gamblers, 6 times 8 is 48% of your casino revenues are coming from problem and pathological gamblers. And that is a number which I first noticed in the early 1990s because I was hearing numbers about what an average adult lost in Atlantic City if they live 35 miles from the casino versus the average loss of a problem or pathological gambler. So you're talking about hundreds of dollars a year for an average person versus thousands of dollars a year for a pathological gambler. It doesn't take very many of the latter to explain a large portion of the total. And so bottom line, slot machines are the worst form of gambling, the most addictive, most harmful, and I think it's because you can lose a lot of money very fast at those machines.
And Dr. Grinnells, just again from your research, can you answer, is it possible to have a successful, economically successful casino model without having a significant problem pathological clientele? In other words, do you need to create and sustain a problem and pathological clientele in order for the economic model of a casino to work?
And that is also a very good question. And here's the problem of gambling. Most people who gamble don't run into problems. We're talking maybe 1%, possibly 2% who will become pathological due to the presence of gambling. We're talking about 2%, maybe 3% who might become problem gamblers. But we're talking about a tiny proportion of the population that suffer severe problems. And by the way, that should be, I think, compared to a children's toy. If a children's toy were found to have the same damage on the same proportion of users that gambling does, there's no question that children's toy would be banned outright. There's no controversy, I think, about such a statement. But I asked a gambling treatment psychologist. This is a person who knows treatment for pathological gamblers. If you would write a paper for a symposium I was putting together to answer this question, could it be possible to change the way in which gambling is offered in some fashion so that the social damage would not be caused? Could you clean up gambling so those of us who like to gamble can do it without hurting ourselves or anybody else? We're not going to destroy our family's finances and so on. Can we just have our recreational fun and people who want to run a casino, run their casino? He said, that's a question I've never been asked before, but let me think about it. And he took a good long time to write the paper. The thing that, and I can get the committee a copy of his paper, but every single thing that he came up with was something that would lower the revenues of the casinos. They were things like limit your hours of operation. Don't allow any automatic teller machines anywhere near the casino. Slow down the speed of play. There were other similar suggestions of that type. But if you take slot machines, for example, these things are designed to extract money from the gambler as quickly as they can. They talk, in the industry, they talk about gambling to exhaustion. That means extracting the full amount of money that the gambler has and keeping them at the machine until you've extracted it all. And of course they would think that. That's their business, to separate a slot machine user from their money. And the suggestions of this individual would totally alter and, in fact, almost make the industry unviable. And if, in fact, you succeeded, consider you're cutting off half the revenues of the industry. Half the revenues would disappear if gambling were able to be offered in a safe, unharmful way.
Thank you. I do want to see if members of the committee have questions. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, you've listed a number of social costs in presenting what appears to be I believe you said a 3-to-1 ratio of cost to benefit.
Roughly 3-to-1.
Could you list for me what some of the social benefits would be to gambling within your analysis?
And I started the talk with the social benefits. The social benefits of gambling are the value that people place on having an additional form of recreation to them. And to measure that value, there are several ways to go about it, and I have done this. It's described in my book. The issue is directly you can infer the value from how much people gamble at what distances they are from the casino. This is explained in my book, and the number is on the handout that I think you have. But it's a number on the order of $50 per year per adult. Okay, so that's the value. Now, if you ask where will that $50 end up in your economy, depends on how it's being offered, but some of that money is going to end up as monopoly profits. In the case of Minnesota, it'll end up as monopoly profits in the hands of the Indian casinos, because that's the way it's being offered in the state. If you say taxes are a benefit of casinos because the state gets taxes from casinos, or you might say business profits are a benefit of the casinos, you have to be very careful, because if you just do the mathematics of all of social benefits, what you find is it's the increase in profits of all business that is a social benefit. It's the increase to the state from all taxes that's a social benefit. And so what tends to happen is people will say, we've hired 100 people at the casino, that's a social benefit. No, it's not. Not if all 100 of those jobs were eliminated from some other alternative location in the economy. You've got to, it's net impact that has to be considered. And the casinos will say, we paid, $100 million in taxes. That's a social benefit. No, it's not. It has to be netted out against lost taxes elsewhere. But there is a way that you can take the total that I began with, parse it out across the locations in the economy where it will appear, and you can calculate the benefits directly the way I've described, you can also calculate it by summing up all the tax consequences, all the business profit consequences, all the other consequences. And if you do them properly, they're going to give you the same answer. And I've done it both ways in my book. And so the answer is that it shows up as net. You know, you can sometimes have net jobs created, net taxes increased, and so on. I don't know if that's a very clear answer.
It was, Mr. Chairman, a rather lengthy, meandering answer, but it sounds to me like some of the social benefits may lie in the area of jobs, taxes, and those types of things. And where I'm going with my questions is, if you have got a 3-to-1 ratio cost to benefit analysis for gambling, my question is that in general, or is that, for instance, with the state of Minnesota, which has nothing but Indian-style gambling casinos with no tax benefit to the state of Minnesota? That's the direction that I was going with my question. So, for instance, in the state of Minnesota, is your cost to benefit ratio worse under our Indian compacts versus, say, Las Vegas, where obviously they are paying enormous sums of money?
I think the answer to that is the ratio is not worse in Minnesota. It just means that the benefits are all going to, in this case, the Indian tribes, and virtually none of the benefits are going to the rest of the people of the state, which would require some taxes to transfer the benefits to the people of the state. So I wouldn't say it makes the cost-benefit ratio worse here. I would say it alters who gets the gains and who gets the losses.
One more question?
Yes, Senator Newman.
Yeah, and thank you for that. Now, I also want to go back. You had mentioned Minnesota has, I wrote down, Elizabethan-style monopoly. I thought it was a rather interesting.
Crown monopolies, yeah.
What was it? What kind of monopoly?
Crown monopolies.
Yeah. Just explain that for me, if you would. That was an interesting phrase.
Right. Queen Elizabeth, to reward favored courtiers like Sir Francis Drake and other people, would grant to them the exclusive right to conduct certain types of business in the British realm. And this was used by her as a reward to them for their services to her as the queen. So these are, for all practical purposes, Elizabethan crown monopolies.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not related questions, but you described about 1% of the population is considered pathological and gamblers, and 2-3% problem.
In an area that has had gambling long enough to kind of get to that position.
And further, that moving to that 1% or 2-3% is accelerated by certain kinds of gambling. So my question is, if you expand the locations and the opportunities for gambling in the state or in the country, does that number remain fixed? So the expansion of gambling doesn't change what percentage of the population will become problematic?
No, it's the slide that I was showing that had the bar graphs with Las Vegas, or the nation at the left in 1975 and Las Vegas on the far right in the year 2000, was intended to show what the National Gambling Impact Study Commission concluded, which was that the closer you were to a gambling venue, the greater the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling you would experience. So there's the numbers that you have on this summary were calculated by presuming a baseline level of problem gambling and pathological gambling, even if there were no legal gambling opportunities anywhere. And apparently some people managed to become pathological gamblers just by gambling with their friends or however they might gamble. But once you introduce actual casinos, those numbers rise. And the cost numbers, when I calculate the 3-to-1 ratio, those cost numbers are calculated by saying, we're increasing the number of pathological gamblers by this much. We're increasing the number of problem gamblers by that much. Those increases carry with them the associated social costs that they are responsible for, and putting numbers to that. And so it is the increase in the problem in pathological gambling that we're worried about primarily. There are other social costs related to gambling that don't operate through problem and pathological gamblers. But, for example, the woman who killed herself after gambling away the college savings and the mortgage money had no psychological problems before. They were created, in her case, because of the gambling. And so she would be counted as a social cost due to the gambling.
Senator Sharon and then Senator Mark.
Just one follow-up. Did you want to speak to my point?
Maybe on that point, sure, if Senator I could, Mark. Real quick. I think that was again, a good but maybe long answer. I think that Senator Sharon's question was regarding prevalence within the community, and you're 1 or 2% of pathological and 2 or something of problem was of gamblers. And so when you expand venues and entry points into gambling, you, my assumption would be that you would expand the gamblers as well when you get new venues. And so the 1% applied to a larger...
Those percentages are population percentages.
They're population percentages.
That's of the entire population, right.
Dr. Grinnell, though, isn't the point of that one graph that you showed us is that if the more casino-style venues you create, you tend to approach that Las Vegas model, which is not 1% and 2%, but it was 4% and 3%.
Yeah, and the Las Vegas model, in my opinion, the Las Vegas model would be the end of the line. In other words, they've got as much gambling as you can possibly have available, easily accessible to everybody. And so it probably will not get any worse than the Las Vegas bars on the right-hand side of the graph. But yeah, the whole point is that the more gambling you have, the more of the problems you create, and expanding will expand the problems. Shrinking it back will shrink the problems back. And that's where the costs are. That's how the costs are calculated.
Senator Sharon, did you want
to? Yeah. I have to think that through a little further, obviously. But because if we're talking about population in Las Vegas, so much of it is coming in and out. I don't know how you measure that. So the other question I have is about Internet gambling and geography. One of the things that has been changing, of course, is the impact of the loss of geographic distances that occur if you're talking about miles traveled rather than Internet interaction. So how is the Internet and access to gambling by the Internet going to impact what you're talking about here?
That's the same question I was asked last night. I don't know of any research that I can point to, not my own or anyone else's, that answers that question directly. The only thing I can give you is a judgment based on kind of my reading and thinking about the issue. Pathological gamblers often follow a pattern of having gone to the casino, maybe used a slot machine the first time they won $5,000, and for some people, something snaps in their behavior, in their thinking, or their brain function, and then they become pathological gamblers. Now, if you or I were to go and have the same thing happen, maybe that wouldn't affect us the same way. So there's a notion that maybe a certain fraction of the population has a latent propensity to this type of pathology, and that latent propensity, which is already there, is just expressed when the opportunity to gamble is offered. Now, I'm getting to your question. Here's a story that relates to this. This is from a student of mine who happened by chance to have his first job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He was trained as an international trade economist, but because he worked there, he thought he would do a little foray into some gambling research. And so he did some gambling research, and part of that involved going to a Gambler Anonymous meeting, which runs kind of on the lines of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. But he told this story. He said a woman stood up, and I guess the formula is I'm, you know, so-and-so, I'm a gambler or pathological gambler or whatever. She said she discovered she had a problem when she realized that she had bought herself extra thick, extra absorbent sweatpants because she could ignore, I guess, the call of nature twice, up to two times at the gambling table and not have to leave the table to go to the restroom. She said, I suddenly realized you've got a problem. If gambling is that big a pull on you that you're doing this, then you need to get help. And so that's how she decided. Okay, now to your question. If, in fact, gambling operates because of the speed of play and the flashing lights and the so on, and it just affects some people in a particular way, and the thrill to them, which is just a huge excitement of getting a winning, and you can get that on a terminal at your home any time of the day or night. You can wander in your bathrobe and gamble. I would have to guess that it would resemble slot machines in its impact, but possibly an elevated slot machine impact. And so if I had to make a single prediction or point guess, it would be this would be even worse than slot machines by far. And the only other item that I have not heard talked about a lot is the fact that if you have online gambling, the people who are selling that have an ability to produce fraudulent probabilities. You just shave your probabilities a little bit. It's almost impossible to detect, almost impossible. And gambling has historically been used as a vehicle for fraud. So I think that online gambling has an even greater opportunity for that kind of problem as well.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Grinnells. You know, when you're in Las Vegas, you can go to restaurants that don't have slot machines in them. I mean, a lot of the smaller towns in Las Vegas, you can't find one. I mean, you can't. I was on a road trip with my family once through Nevada, and you know, it didn't matter. You know, if you were trying to eat eggs at 6 in the morning, you had these things going off all around you. But in Las Vegas, there are a lot of family restaurants that don't have the slot machines in them. I mean, you can be in Las Vegas and not have a gambling experience if you choose not to, unless you go down on the strip where the casinos are. So I'm just wondering if your assumption that Las Vegas is the sort of the worst things could get is really true.
And Las Vegas is an interesting case. There, what I'm saying about Las Vegas is a couple of things. First, the state senator, I think, from Rhode Island, who was the one who said, well, I went to Las Vegas. I didn't see anything that was a problem. So what are you talking about? But I asked him, I said, well, what were you expecting to see? Is crime, you don't see crime. We're not talking street crime here. We're not talking muggings and people being robbed at the door of a casino. The crimes and the impact of these crimes are often, they're hidden. You're not going to see them by walking on the street. What Las Vegas has done is to convert itself into an entertainment convention and gambling center. So it is, and it almost... I think it gets in the like 35 million visitors a year. The number of visitors per resident is very great. So there, if your geographical market for your casino is larger than the geographical area of interest, in the case of Las Vegas, their market is the whole West Coast, really, effectively. You can economically develop an area, meaning more economic activity will be taking place in that geographical region that you mark on the map. So Las Vegas has expanded in that sense, and that is economic development as most people term it. They are also within their local resident population suffering huge social costs from addiction and problems related to gambling. So they have made a deal. They've made a bargain. We think that the benefits over here outweigh the stuff over here, but what they're getting over here is present, and it's there to a greater extent than other parts of the country. The difference is, in Minnesota, you're not going to convert any part of the state. Well, you could, I suppose, but it's not likely that you're going to convert any part of the state into a replica of the Las Vegas development experience.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to imply that things were not bad in Las Vegas. I only meant to say that I didn't think using that as a measure of how bad it could get was necessarily appropriate. I've been to Las Vegas on a number of occasions and never been near any gambling. But I have also been to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and had a hard time finding a place to go where there wasn't some little gambling in the corner. So that was my only point.
Yeah, and people who talk about Atlantic City, which is another example, say that they regret what happened to Atlantic City in its overall configuration because of gambling. I heard a man who was on the city council that voted in gambling into Atlantic City, and he said outright, he said, I was on the city council, I voted for it, I regret what I did, I realize now it was a mistake, I wish I had never done it, and that's part of the reason why I'm now speaking to you, and you know, when I get chances I speak on the matter, because he said I made a mistake, it was harmful to the city. And you know, if you look at the number, there are statistics you can find. The number of restaurants in Atlantic City actually declined as a result of the gambling. They had far more before gambling than they have now. The reason is gambling often uses restaurants as a loss leader to get people into the casino. So if you're competing with a casino and you're a restaurant, you're half a mile away or, you know, reasonable distance away, you're not going to find gamblers, you know, wandering outside the casino to come to your restaurant and use your restaurant. You're not going to sell novelties or souvenirs nearby. The gamblers who come gamble, they stay in the casinos. The casinos do everything they can to keep them in the casinos until they've gambled their money away. And the spin-off benefits, if there are any, to a local area come primarily from the money earned by the people who work in the casinos who spend the money locally. And if that's just diverted jobs, then that's not even going to be a gain.
Other questions from the members of the committee? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, you've indicated that, in your opinion, casino-style slot machines are the worst or the most addictive, or however we would phrase it. In your opinion, where would electronic pull tabs fall within the list of forms of gambling as to whether it's, you know, good, bad, or indifferent?
Ask a quick question. Is there any limit on how many pull tabs you could buy electronically at a point in time? Could I lose $10,000 in a space of 10 minutes or something?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
Okay.
Well, the reason I'm asking, Doctor, is that there is an idea or a bill floating around the Capitol right now to put electronic pull tabs into bars, bowling alleys, restaurants, et cetera. And candidly, I really don't know very much about them. That's why I'm asking the question.
Okay, two parts to my answer. One is, I, without knowing the details, I would classify them as electronic gaming machines and put them in the slot machine category. But the other thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that, well, there's a slippery slope argument, and if you do put whatever you put into the locations that you put these pull tab machines, what will happen is it won't be very many years before requests will come to expand, to change the nature of the machines, to add some games. You know, the pull tab game we're using now used to earn us a lot of money, but now it's kind of fallen off a little bit. We need to have a new, more modern game. And there will be pressure to expand. In the case of Iowa, the original gambling was to have a little bit of old-style, nostalgic riverboat casinos to ply the Mississippi. There were betting limits. There were hours that they had to operate on the river and so on. Within a few years, they eliminated the betting limits. They put ATM machines on board, and then the request came not to even have to go on the river. Why do we have to? What's the point of cruising on the river? Let's just stay moored. And so the slippery slope argument, I think, is a valid argument with respect to this kind of a proposal. And more, so I'm saying more dangerous than what might initially be proposed is what you're going to end up with, and that'll be slot machines.
Thank you. Other questions? I did, before we let you depart for wherever you need to go, Dr. Grinnells, you do have in your list of social costs, you have a political cost, or at least it's on the list here, but there's nothing, no dollars associated with that. Could you just comment briefly about
what I found that interesting. I did get asked to consult with the New Hampshire Policy Institute, and they did their own study. That is their work and their original product, not mine. And I have never listed political costs as a social cost of gambling in any work of my own, so I found it very interesting that they put political costs on there. And I do have plenty of interaction with people who tell me the political costs are huge. And what one individual said was this, you know, I'm talking to senators, so you guys know more about politics than I do. But what this individual said is you have no idea what you are going to get into and how much pressure will be and can be brought to bear on the legislature if gambling becomes a major presence in your state. They will take over. And, you know, I was in Hawaii 2 months ago. I was lucky to be able to meet with the governor for just a short time and talk with him and so on. And he just didn't want to believe it. But I had a former president pro tempore of a state senate tell me, you can tell people from my perspective, they own this state. Now, he did ask me, please don't, I don't want you to mention my state's name. It's a major state. It's a big state. It's, you know, it's a state you would know. But he said, you can tell them they own the legislature. In the case of New Hampshire, Jim Rubens, who I think it's fine for me to mention this, his name in regard to this story, because he himself has publicly stated this, said when he was a state senator, what got him alarmed to gambling was receiving unbidden a letter with $5,000, I think it was $5,000 in cash, from a gambling organization. And he got this envelope and this money and said, what am I getting this money for? And he called them up, and they had some, you know, fig leaf kind of excuse as to, well, this is for such and such or whatever, your services and so on. But he said this was wrong, and he didn't like it, and he found other people were getting the same kind of treatment. And so that got him started down his road, and he is now a strong opponent of expanding gambling in New Hampshire. But the underhandedness with which gambling has expanded in state after state after state has been well documented. I can give you stories in New York where they violated the Constitution, meeting at times in the dark of night when they weren't supposed to be able to legally hold meetings in Missouri and so on. In South Carolina, the industry was able to expand slot machines to every truck stop, bar, restaurant, and whatever illegally. The legislature was able to do nothing to reverse it. They got nothing done. It was the Supreme Court of the state of South Carolina that said, this is illegal, this is unconstitutional, this came in inappropriately, this will stop. And it was only the Supreme Court that removed the slot machines from South Carolina. So if you want to read a book, you can read Bad Bet on the Bio. It's a story related to gambling in Louisiana. This has been documented all over the place. It's not hard for you to find documentation of political corruption that this will bring. But the gambling industry very quickly becomes the most biggest and the most powerful lobby. Let me give you one other anecdote. This is a cute one. I was invited to Richmond, Virginia to talk about a casino proposal in the city of Richmond, Virginia. The man that wanted me to speak owned a restaurant that was from a converted tobacco warehouse that he had lovingly built up over the years. It was a very prominent and well-known restaurant. And he said, this is not right. If they can offer gambling and food at their casino, but I am prohibited legally from offering gambling, how can I compete with something that wants to locate just down the street? So he wanted me to testify to one of their committees, which I did. In that committee meeting, here's what I learned. The gambling industry had hired every single lobbyist, all of them, 100% of the lobbyists in the city of Richmond, so that their opponents would be unable to have any lobbyists working on their side. In fact, they didn't hire everybody. There were two lobbyists who refused the gambling industry's offer of hire, but that's what they did. Now, in Texas, in Austin, I told that same story to a man who worked in the, he was in a commission, kind of a public think tank. He laughed at the story. He said, that's a good story, Earl, but you think 70 lobbyists is a big number. In Austin, Texas, when gambling is on the agenda, we get over 700 lobbyists on the issue hired by the industry. He said they descend on the Capitol building like locusts. And that's his word. But I don't know how I can make the case and put it into economic costs, but if you let gambling become a major presence, it will take over. And that's what people tell me. So I'm just repeating what I hear.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, I just want to again thank you for taking the time to be here today. And we would certainly like to have access to or a copy of your presentation that I can get distributed to the members of the committee.
I'll make something available.
But we appreciate the information that's been helpful from my perspective. We are continuing to have this debate. We wanted to have an opportunity to hear you in this committee. This committee does deal with a lot of costs that are related to different social issues, and so we thought it was appropriate to have your comments appear in this committee. So thank you very much for that. And members, we're going to take a brief recess to kind of get reorganized before we start taking up bills. We'll reconvene about 11, about 10 minutes. So just a brief recess. Thank you.